somebody had walked out on the screening and was out by a bathroom or something, and he ran into John McNaughton, and the guy's like, "You can't do that. You can't do what you just did in this movie." And McNaughton's like, I did do that.
Welcome to Recotopia, a happy home for recommended movies, shows, and music from two people you can definitely trust. Trustability varies by region, no guarantees implied. Now, here are your hosts, Chris Atkinson and Jeremy Scott.
What is in this house? Speak to John. John is with us.
Hello, everybody. Hey. It is episode 34 of Recotopia.
Yeah. Welcome,
everyone. I am Chris Atkinson.
And I'm Jeremy Scott.
And today's big recommend is going to be 1980's The Changeling. Hello, everybody out there in the chat who have come to watch us on Tuesday. Already lively there in the comments.
Indeed.
On Twitch and YouTube and all the things. Anyway, how you doing? How's everybody doing?
Everybody good? Everybody good? Ready for some recommends?
Mm-hmm. Huh? Let's do some recommends, yeah.
It's no big deal.
It's so small and light.
It's small, it's tiny, it's petite, it's wee.
Yes. I will kick it off. This week, I have two. Both my small recommends are documentaries.
Oh.
Which is a little outside of my wheelhouse. The first one is called Blind Ambition.
Okay.
This movie was released, according to the internet, on September 2nd and is currently still in select theaters. I imagine you'd have to go to L.A. or New York to see it. Mm-hmm. I bought it on Amazon, or rented it, actually, I should say. So if you have an Amazon account and some spare dollars, you can rent this now and watch it. I imagine it will be streaming soon. This is about four guys from Zimbabwe who had left Zimbabwe separately. They didn't know each other as refugees and moved to South Africa. And once they got to South Africa, they tasted wine for the first time, met each other, and formed a wine tasting competitive team that actually went to the World Wine Tasting Championships in Bordeaux. I think it's in... Well, it's in some area of France that's mm-hmm. super famous for wine.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, Zimbabwe, since the mid-90s, there have been, I think, some 3 million people who have fled to other countries because of the financial disparity there. And one of the guys in the film even says the ride to work on the bus costs an entire month's salary. So that's sort of the financial situation that they were facing. And they all have similar stories, even though they didn't know each other in Zimbabwe, about the kind of hardships they were facing. One of them is a sommelier. Another one is some kind of a like sommelier in training. And basically this film follows them as they spend the last month before this tournament cram training on being expert wine tasters.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just charming as hell and kind of inspiring because these guys had nothing.
Yeah.
And when the movie's over, it tells you, you know, this one owns his own winery and this one has his own restaurant and wine tasting bar in this part of the world. They've just all grown so much from their bonded love of wine, and not only wine in general, but wine tasting. Actually, it's very frustrating watching this movie if you drink wine to enjoy it, like I do, because they're constantly spitting it out and like they roll it around in their mouth, but they can't get drunk. They got to taste 12 right. different wines.
Yeah.
It's just fascinating to me that they were able to, you know, fall in love with this sport, I guess, and then get good enough to go and compete on an international level. Just really, really fascinating, really charming. And so that's my first small recommend, Blind Ambition. You can rent it on Amazon, but I imagine at some point it will be $2.99 everywhere on your digital service of choice.
I think it's amazing that there are people out there who can just by taste tell you what the year and the where it came from and all of that. Like, I know that requires like a long time and a lot of experience and all that, but I just, God, how in the world does that even happen? It's a taste.
There's so many scenes of them practicing where their coach will give them a blind wine and they'll taste it and they'll go around. And, oh, the dryness makes me think that this is old world. Oh, I get a little bit of tree bark in there. That must be from Spain. And it's just remarkable how often one of them is pretty much dead on.
Mm-hmm.
But when they get to the competition, it's crazy hard. Even the people that like regularly win it are telling the camera, like, it's really hard. You have to guess.
Of course it is.
The maker of the wine is one of the four things you have to guess right. Like, yeah, the actual bottler. Crazy.
That is insane. Okay, so I watched a movie that I know that you love as well, and may end up being a big recommend someday, I'm assuming. But this was during one of the monthly movie nights that I have with this one group of friends and everything. Somebody picked The Talented Mr. Ripley as one of the movies, and this movie came out in 1999. This is Matt Damon just hot off the presses of Good Will Hunting and Saving Private Ryan, in this, playing Tom Ripley, a man who was sent by this guy's father, Dickie Greenleaf's father, played by James Reborn, sent to Italy to go find Dickie Greenleaf and bring him back. He wants him back in the States. And Tom goes there and runs into Dickie and finds out that Dickie doesn't much want to leave Italy at all, doesn't care too much. And how in the world are you supposed to argue somebody's way back to America? I've never understood this whole premise, but the father believes that it can be done. In the meantime, Tom is already mistaken for Dickie right off the bat in the early going by Kate Blanchett, who you see this, she's right off of Elizabeth when this movie comes out. You just wish she could be in this more, but her character is key in this a lot, because as soon as she thinks that he's Dickie, it becomes a big plot point by the end of the movie. But Tom befriends Dickie and even loves Dickie. Dickie is dating Gwyneth Paltrow, but he's also got some other woman on the side. And she knows it, but it's kind of like, you know, it's like one of those weird, I don't care, but I do care. But
yeah,
that kind of type of deal. But Tom is definitely living the life in Italy and wants to hang out with Dickie constantly. And it's interesting to me, once Philip Seymour Hoffman comes in and is playing that, was it Frankie Miles or something like that is his name?
Freddie
Miles. He's playing this other friend of Dickie's that comes in, and like, he's listening to music and all that, and he's getting Dickie to come in and listen to the same music with him. It's amazing, like, how Tom starts to seem needy when you start seeing him through Freddie's eyes. Like, all the time you're sitting there like, oh, this is a nice friendship, this is cool, he's always hanging out with Dickie. And then when Freddie shows up, suddenly Tom says something about like wanting to join him at a party or something. You see Freddie and he's like, he just kind of laughs at him like, well, who is this dude? You know,
he sees right through him immediately.
Yeah, immediately. And of course, this has that great, we have used a million times in videos before, where Philip Seymour Hoffman's like, Tommy, how's the peeping? Tommy, how's the peeping? The soundtrack to this is the score to this is beautiful. They use a similar piece all the way throughout the movie, but it's just great. It's very mysterious and everything. But I don't know how much I need to spoil this, but I'll say this. Tom ends up pretending to be Dickie full time in this movie.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And a lot of things depend on him. Some people knowing that he's Tom Ripley and some people knowing that he's Dickie Greenleaf. And he's got to play that juggling act the entire like third act of this movie.
Yeah.
And it's a wonderful movie. It's a great movie. It's an Anthony Minghella movie for people who hated The English Patient. So,
like me.
Yeah, like Jeremy. this movie is really fantastic. It was great to see a revisit on this one. I hadn't seen it in a while. A Talented Mr. Ridley. Jude Law is great. Jude Law is also coming straight off of Gattaca. Mm-hmm. Where I think that was his breakthrough and everything. So a lot of people in this movie are just becoming big stars. Gwyneth Paltrow had been one for a bit, even though she's kind of shoved to the side a little bit. But she's really good in this, too. She's got some moments in this movie that are great. So, I'd highly recommend this.
Yeah, it's good stuff. I've probably seen that movie 20 times.
Mm-hmm.
And it just gets better and better and better. All right.
Yeah.
My second small recommend is another documentary. You may remember a few weeks back that Chris recommended a film called 13 Lives, which is starring Viggo Mortensen and Colin Farrell and Joel Edgerton. And it's about the rescue of the 12 soccer players and their coach that got trapped in the caves in Thailand.
Mm-hmm.
There's a documentary. There's actually two. But there's a documentary on Disney Plus called The Rescue.
Mm.
And I sat down after I watched 13 Lives with my wife and watched The Rescue on Sunday. Really good, really riveting. This actually, I turned to my wife about 2/3 of the way through and said, if I did not know how this ended up in real life, I could not watch this movie.
Yeah.
It would make me so freaking anxious. And if you scripted this as a movie instead of basing it on a real event, the studio head would throw the script back at you and ask for something more realistic.
Mm-hmm.
Because the rescue they pull off is insane.
It's absurd.
Mm-hmm. And when you heard about it in the news, you did not hear about what they did. Mm-hmm. You just heard that they dove them out and rescued them. But they basically tranked these kids with a cocktail of drugs multiple times throughout the cave swim.
Mm-hmm.
And the guy that they get to help him do it initially was like, no, I could probably list 50 different ways that they're going to die doing this. This is, you can't do this. And it ultimately becomes the only option. Very fascinating to watch the real footage of the things that I saw the dramatized version of. Because as no matter how good an actor Viggo Mortensen and Colin Farrell are, they can't play normal weird dude as well as a normal weird dude can. And these guys, like when they're being introduced on screen, it's like IT specialist / cave diving hobbyist.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
They're just old, weird, skinny British dudes who have done this as a hobby so much. And I love the interviews with them. You don't get any of that in the dramatized version where they explain why they love cave diving and mm-hmm. why, even though it's so scary and isolated and it's like space, they're so anxious in their normal lives that being alone in a dark cave with the unknown is actually the most peaceful place and time for them.
Mm-hmm.
And they're just really fascinating, weird, weird individuals. What's extra cool about this documentary, I'm sorry, I'm going too long, is that there are some scenes that they clearly had to stage. For instance, the first dive the two guys make into the cave, there is footage of guys in a cave laying some wire diving. But you know that's not them because they didn't film that themselves.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But then when they first reached the kids, one of the guys in real life broke out a camera and started filming.
Mm-hmm.
And the documentary goes into the camera and boom, you're seeing that actual footage. It's not staged. And then as the film goes on, you kind of can't tell anymore which sections were staged and which sections are real. At one point, my wife was like, I think this is real. I think this is real footage. And I was like, I think you're right. Mm-hmm. When they're like bringing them out on stretchers and everything. It's really, really fascinating rescue and story. And if you had any interest in 13 Lives or watched it and liked it, I think this would be a nice chaser. It's on Disney Plus. It's called The Rescue.
Definitely need to see this. When I watched 13 Lives, I did watch I think this is what you were describing. I did watch a YouTube video of the scene in the movie where Colin Farrell is telling them that he's going to get them food and everything, and that becomes a big thing with Viggo later, where he's like, "They ain't ever getting out of this fucking thing." They showed that video is on YouTube, though, of him telling all the kids we're going to come back. Yeah. Now, I don't think he tells them. I think they did this for dramatization. I don't think he tells them that we're going to come back with food and doctors and all that, like Colin Farrell. Colin Farrell, like, promises the moon in that thing.
But some of what he says, some of Farrell's dialogue is straight from that real video where he says, like, "You are so strong." It gave me chills. Anyway, good stuff.
My next recommend is going to come with some caveats because this movie is disturbing. It's Henry, Portrait of a Serial Killer, starring Michael Rooker. This is like super young Michael Rooker. He's like in his early 30s in this. I want to stress to people that if you don't like horror movies and you don't like seeing disturbing death on a screen, you do not want to see this movie at all. Mm-hmm. I'm going to go ahead and give you that caveat right now. Mm-hmm. This movie starts off with a string of just seeing the aftermath of what this guy has done to all these women in the area. And all you hear is, you hear like the faint echoes of what happened in the scene in the background while you just see somebody dead on the screen. And it goes on to show Michael Rooker and Henry as this normal dude who's coming to town. He's going to be staying with a buddy. Buddy's going to have his sister living with him and everything. And as one of the commenters says, Henry Lee Lucas. Yes, it is based on a real guy.
Jesus.
Although this guy was convicted of several killings, but he was also one of those guys who would claim like hundreds of killings that he didn't actually do and things like that later on. So Michael Rooker is coming in to live with this dude and his sister. This dude that he's living with, his name's Otis, I believe. He's not a very high intelligence, and he's very dangerous in the way he thinks. He's definitely lurching after his sister during this movie. There's a point where Henry has to stop him from touching her, basically, in the movie. But they sort of form this kind of like hanging out friendship type of thing. But it's not like, when I say hanging out friendship type of thing, I'm not saying like you and me, Jeremy. they pick up some women at a bar, and you're just like, first you're like, Henry seems kind of nice, actually, because this is what the serial killers are. You know, that's one of the things that we always hear about serial killers, right? They're so normal. Yep. They seem so nice, blah, 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 blah. And even he even seems to have like this like affinity for dude's sister and like just caring for her, not like any particular, like, you know, he doesn't want her in any way. It's just, hey, you know, I care for you, blah, blah, blah. They go out and they get some women out of a bar or something like that to go into this car. You see this, it's like both of them are making out with two women in this car. And then all of a sudden, Henry snaps. He snaps this woman's neck, and it's like, "Whoa, I haven't seen him do anything on screen this whole time, and now suddenly he's doing that." And after a while, these guys just go on sprees, and they start like, they start getting video cameras into it and starting to shoot the stuff that they're doing and everything, and. all the different moments in this movie where there's like death going on are just disturbing as hell. And just because of the presentation of it, most serial killer movies, they're like, you're like, whoa, that guy's got a screw loose and everything's all like stylized and everything. This is no stylization at all. That's what makes it even scarier, I think. This guy who directed is John McNaughton, who is, I think, best known for Wild Things. It came out later on in the 90s. He also did Mad Dog and Glory. Okay. If you ever saw that movie. But he did this one, and apparently there was some controversy or like the ending is kind of I don't know, it's up in the air what actually happens and everything. And apparently at a screening, somebody had walked out on the screening and was out by a bathroom or something, and he ran into John McNaughton, and the guy's like, "You can't do that. You can't do what you just did in this movie." And McNaughton's like, I did do that. I highly recommend it for those who can handle it. But I will say that it is pretty disturbing what you're going to see if you watch it. It's not, I wouldn't say it's like just blood and guts everywhere. It's just the way things are shown and portrayed on screen that's going to get you. So, okay. There you go.
All right, that sounds intriguing and fascinating and probably not going to move high up on my personal
probably
list.
Probably not. I wouldn't think
that
so.
Stuff, but I do love the variety in the recommends that we bring on this show.
Yep, absolutely.
To the people. All right, it's time for the big one.
The big recommend.
A new year, time for new growth. Grow your education and skills with Herzing University. Our online behavioral health programs fit your schedule and time. From an 8-month diploma program in health and human services to a 36-month bachelor's in psychology. Grow your behavioral health career with us wherever you are in your education. Your future starts now at Herzing University. Visit us online at herzing.edu or text health to 85109. Online at herzing.edu or text health to 85109.
I'm fine. It's just that you're so big.
It's so huge.
It's a good rule, but this is bigger than rules.
It's bigger on the inside.
Is it?
I noticed.
So the big recommend this week is The Changeling from 1980. George C. Scott in this movie. George C. Scott plays a man who has to stop on the side of the road. It's icy, it's cold, it's blah, blah, blah. There's a phone booth out in the middle of the nowhere.
There is.
he stops the car. They've been pushing this car for some time, and he says, "Oh, it's millions of miles down there, millions of miles." Goes to the phone booth to call somebody to help them out. And while he's doing that, some truck going way too fast, and then another car that pulls out in the middle of the road, and then they hit his wife and his kid. And,
fuck, what an opening.
Yeah. Yes. Now we fast forward. He's moved from New York to Seattle, and he is renting a house from a historical society that is out there. It's very strange. But he rents a house from a historical society, and immediately as he gets acclimated to the house, he starts hearing thumping noises and stuff like that going on. There's this constant sound when he wakes up. It's a doo, doo, doo sound. And, of course, the guy who is hired to look after the house and everything is like, "It's an old house, man. The old house makes noises." You know, we're all of the modern audiences, I'm sure even audiences in 1980 were probably like, "Yep, we've been through this before. This is a haunted house, all right." Everybody's saying that it's you know, the pipes or whatever, or it's the wind, or it's whatever, and it's not. It's a ghost. It's a ghost child, man. It's a ghost child. So yeah. Yeah, as he goes through, he starts getting visions and like, you know, sleepwalking or whatever you want to call it, astral projection, I don't know what you want to call it, but he goes through this house and he starts experiencing things, and like, you know, stuff that's just like happens out of the ordinary, glass breaking as he walks out the door, and he goes to investigate this door that's blocked off, and he goes up into this room and he finds this old child's room. But he sees like this image in his head, or maybe he sees it for real, I don't know, of this child in like drowning in the tub that's upstairs, and there's a music box that's playing the music that he's been playing on the piano this whole time. Did I bury the lead? He's a musician. And he's like working out stuff on his piano, and he's trying to work out this piece of music, and as he plays it, and then like one of the keys doesn't work, he walks away, and then the key like mysteriously gets pressed down and it actually hits the note and everything, and but yeah, then he goes up to this kid's room and he sees this music box which is playing the music that he's been composing this whole time. What's going on with this house? Well, he finds out that he's asking questions, and nobody's lived in that house for years, and somebody at the Historical Society is very stern about the fact that that house should have never been rented to him in the first place, because they didn't go through the proper channels and all that. Eventually he has a séance at this place, and this is a really good séance scene. Like, we've seen a million séance scenes in movies, especially in the modern day, and they're always just eye-rollingly bad. Like, none of them seem very good. This woman actually seems like she's in a trance. I don't know how much pieces of paper she needs for this job, but she's she's writing.
I like how her husband just kind of judges. Okay, she's done with that paper. Let's do another paper.
So he goes through this whole thing and he's asking questions out loud, like, you know, did you die in this house? What is your name? All this stuff. And she's writing down all these things on the piece of paper. Then he, George C. Scott, goes back and plays the recording and can actually hear the child answering back on the recording. And that's where the movie starts getting real. It starts getting real, baby. It's getting real.
Yeah, it does.
This movie ostensibly is like a murder mystery. It's not really. It's got horror elements for sure, but it all comes down to who was the child, why did they die, who killed them, and who benefited? Is there somebody who's benefiting today off of this type of thing? Of course, if you've seen a movie before, you know. You know who's benefiting. This is one of those, I haven't seen it in forever. I saw this with my brother a long time ago, and I remember us really liking it. And when I first started watching this, I was like, oh no, I recommended some movie that's just your basic ass ghost haunted house movie, and it's got all the same tropes that I send in our videos and everything, but it takes a nice turn, I think, and it's well shot. It's beautifully shot. It's incredibly technically great as far as the way it is shot. And George C. Scott is fantastic in it. There are moments in here. I think you might also not want to be, don't want to forget to laugh in at some points, because there's some points in this where he's like, there's that point where they find that other property where the well was, yeah. and they've dug up the hand and everything, and he comes back later and he's sitting there, and then that metal that they were looking for just kind of just comes back through the ground and is just lying there. George C. Scott looks down at this thing and he arches an eyebrow like, there's a metal there all of a sudden. That was expected. And, you know, so but there are some moments in there. There's some moments in here that are actually pretty funny in context. But I'm glad that I revisited this. I think this is a great horror movie. And it's a great mystery overall. And even though I think they pretty much tell you right off who is probably responsible, the whole reasons why and the story behind it and how this all came to be is really interesting. Ended up by the end of it, I was like, I'm glad I recommended this. Anyway, what did you think?
Okay, so this is my first viewing of this movie. I quite liked it. Mm-hmm. And again, I'm with you. The first 30 minutes, I was like, this is basically a haunted house movie. But what makes this movie special is, I think, two things. That murder mystery element that comes in behind the haunting and really changes the tone of the movie. And that's a really well-plotted murder mystery. And then, like you were saying, the way it's shot. Like, there's so many slow, measured pans and zooms. There's entire scenes without dialogue. my cat wants to be on the show. And it's very confident. It knows what it's doing. It's not trying to give you tons of exposition. Sometimes we're just watching George C. Scott react to something and walk around trying to figure out what's going on. I think the ultimate story of the murder, of what happened and why, is fucked up. And the scene where they show you the bathtub incident is really hard to watch. Especially when he starts banging on the side of the tub and connect the dots to, you know, the noises that he's been hearing. I mean, George C. Scott was great. It's shot incredibly. That's a solid mystery underneath just a basic haunted house story. A lot of haunted house stories try to do this. Oh, here's the backstory of what happened here, but they don't get to this level. I even wrote down at some points it feels almost like a Columbo.
Yeah,
if that makes any sense.
Right.
Not in the sense that he's trying to fool people by playing dumb, but just this nagging mystery that he can't let go of, that he has to keep pursuing. And I just really liked it. I would give it 2 thumbs up. Probably a solid B for me. I might need to watch it again. I love the era stuff. Like there's a line she says, like, I tried to call you, but information isn't giving out your number yet.
I was like,
wow, man, like, that is a very specific era in time where that line could be uttered, and it makes sense within context, of course. But I was chuckling after she said that. I was like, well, you have to wait for information to give you the number and then give it to people. Just call information and it's not ready yet. Call back tomorrow. Like, how does that work?
And I can't remember the actress name, but that's George C. Scott and his actual wife in real life in that movie.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
It's Trish Van Devere, who's playing the woman who works at the Historical Society. And everything. There is also, and I wasn't able to confirm this, but there's also a, apparently Joshua Jackson, when he was months old, was in this movie at some point, because like his mom was an assistant director or something like that.
That's wild.
I wasn't able to confirm it anywhere. The IMDb doesn't have him as an uncredited actor here or playing himself or whatever. But I believe his mom worked on this movie, and so he apparently like shows up, and Giancarlo Esposito has an uncredited extra credit on this movie as well. Thought that was really interesting. Getting into a little bit of the spoiler weeds, and I haven't quite, you know, figured out what, you know, what people, if people listen to this and say, oh, I need to watch that movie, or if they're watching the movie and then listening to us or whatever. But I'm going to get into spoiler stuff here so we can talk about it a little bit. But this is another one of those intriguing things that I don't think you could get away with in modern day. Maybe you can get away with this in modern day. But this whole idea that you have a son who is disabled and you kill that kid and then you, like, get an orphan to become your kid or whatever, and then send him off to some European country to get better or whatever. And so when he comes back at 18, he's he's okay. It sounds plausible in this movie. It doesn't sound plausible. Maybe you could do that. Maybe it's regularly done. Who knows? It's an interesting thing. But yeah, it is fucked up. Melvin Douglas, by the way, really good in as the senator in this. This was one of his last movies before he died. He did this and another one called A Ghost Story, or just Ghost Story or something like that, the same year. He's coming off another movie that I would recommend called Being There, he just did. So Melvin Douglas was really good in this. Is that I was wondering what was going on at the very end of this, where he's comparing the medals and he sort of realizes what's going on, and then we see his astral body showing up in the house. Yeah. And as it's burning, and
Doctor Strange Peter Parker'd him, and his spirit showed up or something.
right. There's a lot of cool stuff in here. And Peter Medak, I don't know that director very. I don't know what else have I seen of his. He did Species too. He did the Krays. It looks like he's still doing stuff to this day. It seems like we would have seen more Peter Medak, of him, the way this movie is shot and everything. Mm. It just seems like, you would know his name a little bit more, than you would in this. But anyway, yeah. I highly enjoyed watching this the second time. I'm looking at the chat. It looks like, how many people here are talking about this movie?
Well, it looks like they are. The wheelchair that was terrorizing the woman, and the shot where she falls down the stairs and the wheelchair follows her.
Yes, the sentient wheelchair that terrorized that. Yes, absolutely.
I did want to note that while it is obvious in certain scenes in this movie that George C. Scott is not playing the piano, he did learn to play one piece for the scene in the college classroom, and that's really him playing that. And so even though there's that 360 shot of him in his new house when he's at the piano and he's doing this, and I was just kind of giggling the whole time because that was probably shot before he learned to play the piano for real. But, I like to give actors credit when they actually learn how to play an instrument.
Yeah. We had some speculation that you would be bringing up the piano playing in this movie, and got a boom called it in there.
I believe they know me well, these listeners.
Yes, and exactly. Finn Horror says, bets on whether Jeremy will comment on piano playing in this movie. Yes, absolutely. And then says, yep. Ben called it. And James Kendler says, great creepy score by Rick Wilkins. Yes, Rick Wilkins' score is great in this as well.
Yes, it is.
I was worried this was, because in the modern day, these haunted house movies are all the same. They're almost all the same. So when I started watching this, I was like, oh, was I in a different place in my life? I was in a different place in my life when I was watching this the first time. But I was like, oh man, did I think this was great? And it's just an average, haunted house movie and whatever. And it really, really pulls through. I was really excited about that because I didn't want to come on here and go, guys, I blew it,
Well, I'll tell you what, there is one movie that I'm circling, thinking of recommending someday in the future that I have not seen since I was 7. And I looked it up, and it's not well reviewed, but I'm still thinking about recommending it. So don't feel bad if you ever recommend one you haven't seen in forever and it turns out bad.
Yeah. So anyway,
I will be there to do the same.
I was wondering, what did you think would be a good double feature for this movie?
Be very, very quiet.
Secret? What secret?
Our dirty little secret.
I tell you something I've never told anyone.
I'll tell you what, the first 30 minutes, I was like, can I name anything other than a Paranormal Activity or your straightforward haunted house movie? And then, thank God, that murder mystery came in and gave me some options, because I don't want it percolating. That's what I meant. So The one I almost went with, I'm not going to give you 12 today. I'm only going to give you an almost and the actual one.
Okay.
One I almost went with was Girl with the Dragon Tattoo.
Ooh, yeah.
Because of that dark, gothic murder mystery with generational family secrets and really fucked up ultimate understanding of the mystery. But I did want to try and include a little bit of horror elements into this. And there's not really any horror in that. So I'm going to recommend for a double feature, Stir of Echoes.
Oh, nice.
With Kevin Bacon. And this is about a man living in a new house, a house that's new to him, who sees a ghost and gets obsessed with the mystery of who killed her. And it's pretty fucked up what happened. And so it's like a 70-something on Rotten Tomatoes. So, you know, if you go by that as your gospel, then maybe you won't like it. I remember when I've only seen it once. I remember really liking it and feeling like it was a shame it came out in the shadow of The Sixth Sense. So that's my double feature, Stir of Echoes. I don't know where you can find it. And yes, it got buried by The Sixth Sense. It's almost like these people have listened to us for a long time and, you know, do the show in our stead if we needed them.
All summer during 1999, we saw trailers for The Sixth Sense, Stir of Echoes, and Stigmata. All those trailers were on movies forever, it seemed like, and they all came out in like the next month or two of each other. I really loved Stir of Echoes too. I'm glad you brought that one up. That's a good one. And we might even have to fully recommend that one day.
Yes, we might. I can't spell. So next week's homework. Are you guys ready?
Yeah, let's do it.
We're gonna stick with the horror theme. And I'm going to recommend 2020's Spontaneous.
Spontaneous. Yes.
This is available on Amazon Prime. It's available on Paramount Plus, on the Roku channel, with a premium subscription, Sling TV and Pluto? Philo with a premium subscription, and available to rent on all of the other streaming places. Now, I want to tell you, before you watch Spontaneous, I would advise you to go to doesthedogdie.com and look for Spontaneous, because this movie does have a lot of triggers. Teenagers literally spontaneously combust, sometimes on screen. There's drug use, alcohol, a lot of triggers. So go and check that and make sure that this movie is not going to trigger you. But what I love about Spontaneous is it's a genre hopper. It's definitely got one foot planted in horror, but there's rom-com, there's coming of age, there's some sci-fi, and there's some drama. And I haven't seen it in probably a year, so I'm excited to get back to it. It's one of my favorite recent movies, and I can't wait to share it.
Yeah, I love it too. I can't wait to see it again.
All right, yes. Okay, let's do some questions.
Yeah.
Question.
I got something to say.
I want the truth.
I'm listening.
What is the most petty movie hill you will die on?
Okay, so, you know, I could go on for days about this Die Hard as a Christmas movie thing, but I'm not, because I think that argument has now reached, what would you want to call it? Like, everybody's just firmly entrenched in their, whatever their belief is about that. And you're never going to be able to change anybody's mind. One, I don't know if it's petty or not, but one that I will die on is that the book doesn't matter. When you have a movie that comes out and it has something that's unexplained in it or whatever, and then somebody tells you, oh, well, in the book this happens and whatever, meaningless to me. But I constantly see arguments online that this movie is okay because the book fills in the gaps for you, and I'm sorry, it doesn't. It never will. You made the movie so that people would know without having any other material ahead of time. Now, I guess you can make a lot of different arguments about what kind of knowledge you're supposed to have about any kind of movie that you watch. But whenever they sort of like miss stuff and they cut stuff out, or don't ever film it in the first place, I'm always going to be, I'm sorry, that doesn't matter. So anyway.
I feel kind of this way about the MCU TV shows. When I say something about Doctor Strange 2 that bugged me, and I get, well, in WandaVision, and I'm like, you can shut up now. I didn't watch WandaVision. The movie needs to do the job of at least summarizing what I need to know from that television series. And I feel like they're going to lose me over time because now I'm kind of stubborn. Now I kind of don't want to watch WandaVision. But also because I've been told by many people that Doctor Strange 2 basically just undoes all of WandaVision anyway.
It does.
So, I don't want to watch all your shows, MCU. Okay, so I'm going to give my answer, and then I think we got some good ones in the chat. This is very recent, Petty Hill, but The Muppet Christmas Carol is not a horror movie. I made the mistake of jokingly tweeting about this after Danae and Ian and I were arguing about it on Slack. And I got a lot of people going, well, it scared the shit out of me when I was six. And I'm like, hey, you know what? Fucking Snuffleupagus scared the shit out of me when I was six.
Right.
Like, just because a movie has... And then I got some pictures of the Ghost of Christmas Future and how scary he looks. And I'm like, yeah, okay. A movie having a scary moment does not make it a horror movie. This is a Muppet movie.
Yeah.
This is a comedy. Mm-hmm. Just stop with the it's a horror movie because this one thing scared my two-year-old. I'm not here for it.
Yeah, sorry. Exactly. Yeah, I know. I know, man. I know.
All right. We got some fun over here in the chat, I think.
Castro says, yeah, the problem is more with WandaVision than Doctor Strange 2. I mean, yeah, I was sitting there thinking they could have done WandaVision a different way and then made Doctor Strange exactly as it was, and then it would have made more sense to do that and everything. Going up here, somebody's asking you a question. Ketrar saying, Jeremy, wanted to ask for ages now, considering that The Matrix is your favorite movie. I was curious if it's just for the spectacle or if you had some deeper connection to it, as it's also my favorite, all-time favorite, and I saw it at a time where I was a bit lost, so it resonated strongly with me.
No, it's more than the spectacle. The spectacle is great, but it's the themes and how much the movie makes me think that makes it my favorite. That's a good question. Somebody's saying Sin City is a good movie, is a hill to die on. That was just for you.
Yeah, it was just for me. when I read these people's names too, I'm just gonna complete this. I think this is Poop Notch or Poop Notch. Okay. You know, what are you going to... It says, I think it's a... Talking about Die Hard, I think it's a Christmas movie on paper, but not in practice. The only thing that I'll say about Die Hard is that, you know, back in the day when you and Jeremy and I were growing up, Christmas movies always had a connotation of... It was around Christmas, people getting presents, you know, all the things were Christmassy in nature and whatever. And then suddenly, 20 years after Die Hard came out, we started getting some wise asses who wanted to call it a Christmas movie. Anyway, Star Trek First Contact is rote and formulaic.
Where's the boot out of the chat button?
Let's see.
Oh, Joseph.
Casper, you know, I read a really good article last year that laid out the actual thematic reasons Die Hard can be thought of as a... I'm sure you did. Everybody always comes up with something.
I'm sure you did.
Mm-hmm, yep. Joseph says Citizen Kane isn't as good. Are we just doing hot takes now?
What's I think we're deal? Just doing hot takes.
Just
man.
Doing hot takes. yeah. So anyway, yeah. There's a All lot right. of. Oh, let's go to the next one.
All right, another question for you. If you had the chance to watch a movie, I got a little Irish there. Another question for you.
Yeah, another question.
If you had a chance to watch a movie and get live commentary from the director as you watched it, what movie would you pick?
Airplane. I'd want to listen to the Zuckers and Jim Abrahams talk about in general, like what they told the actors during these scenes. I mean, yeah, there's commentary on the actual Airplane Blu-ray or whatever, but I'd like to hear their like spontaneous, you know, watching it with them. And I'd like to hear them delve it. I'd like to be able to pause it and then they can talk about all the different jokes and how they set each one of them up, because they said they defined a certain amount of jokes, like like different kinds of jokes. They counted the number of different kinds of jokes that are in Airplane. And I just wanted to, I want to hear them talk about the, I just want to hear them talk about joke craft the whole time. That's basically what I want to hear through this. But I also want to hear how they directed actors, because a lot of people don't realize how to act those movies at all. And to be able to play it as straight as they did, which in later movies, people kept on having to like wink at the camera about everything that they did. Whereas Airplane, nobody does that. You know, that's something that I would like to know too. How do you tell an actor, look, this line is absurd, but you cannot at any moment pinch your lips or anything that makes it seem like you said something stupid or whatever. You have to say it like this was normal. So anyway, I would love to hear their commentary.
That's a good one. That's a good one. I'm assuming that I would be allowed to interact with them and not merely listen.
Mm-hmm.
That's just an assumption on my part. So I would choose Richard Linklater. I don't really love everything that he's made, mm-hmm. but I feel like he has one of the widest libraries in terms of genre, style, and tone. He seems to be continually searching.
Mm-hmm.
And I was reading up on him in preparation for this question, and there's a point in his life where he was watching 600 movies a year.
Mm.
And he just sounds like a Peyton Manning type who just does so much study of the film art that I think he would have a lot of really interesting insights and things to say about any of his movies. But I'd probably choose one of the before movies, like Before Sunrise, probably.
Yeah, for sure, definitely. Any of those, actually, all three of those Before movies are great. Anyway, on the comments, we have Jagged says, I'd love to sit down with Jordan Peele during any of his three movies. Yes, absolutely. Yeah. Polly Walnut says, live commentary from any Kurosawa Mifune samurai film. I'd love commentary on all of those. Absolutely. Justin says Blazing Saddles. Absolutely. Blazing Saddles trends every year for some various reasons or whatever. And it was on the BBC recently. And a lot of people were saying, oh, you couldn't make this movie today. Well, I don't think you could make certain parts of that movie today. But the theme of that movie and the message of that movie, you definitely could make that today. You probably couldn't do a couple of things that Mel Brooks did back in the day. But Blazing Saddles would be great. Hear Mel Brooks talk about it. Oh, it'd be a whole, like a whole other experience. I would love to sit down and watch Crime Wave with Sam Raimi, says Finn. I thought it was actually hilarious, even though I can see why it didn't really work for most audiences. Yeah, and I saw Crime Wave on the sort of the tail end of watching a bunch of Raimi and Coen movies, and this movie was just like it just felt like garbage to me. I haven't seen it in forever, but I may have to revisit it at some point. Everybody, we got a lot of comments on this one. Tenet for me. Yeah, Tenet, Christopher Nolan, because Inception is one I can kind of understand. Yeah, Tenet is tough. Even if you watch the making of Tenet, the best thing about Tenet is watching that hour-long making of where they said, we came in that day and I was like, okay, I know this is how we're going to be doing this scene. And then Christopher Nolan would come in and show like the screen, like the actual things that are going on during the scene. And I would be like, and we'd have arguments about whether we're going forward, where we're going backward, where we're going blind. You know, like even they didn't know a lot of times. That was a discussion also on Twitter. The Legend of Hank is considered sort of a semi remake of Blazing Saddles these days. I haven't seen that yet, but that was also in the discussion about whether you could make Blazing Saddles today or not, or remake it. But a lot of good comments there.
Let's do one more.
Let's do one more.
And, we'll call it. What is a movie where you'd rather spend time with the side plots or side characters than the actual story? My answer, the question asker, would be Four Weddings and a Funeral. Andy McDowell and Hugh Grant characters are the least likable and least interesting people in the movie. The side characters and side plots are all charming. So, yeah, that's a good question.
Yeah, I don't know. That I wasn't able to come up with a rather, but I did come up with a few, like, I would have liked to have been in on their adventures. And I think you did the same thing, too, in your answers. Yep. But Baxter the dog in Anchorman after he gets punted off of the bridge by Jack Black, because he obviously does, he obviously gets into some adventures afterwards, right? Like, yes, because there's that point where like they fall in that lion cage or whatever, and the dog comes in and he says, I met one of your cousins while I was out there. I just thought that would be definitely a fun adventure. The other one was Benny in City of God, since
nice.
He's so cool, and everybody, you know, everybody likes him. He's just all he is a weed dealer, man. He's just a drug dealer. He doesn't kill anybody or do anything. He's just cool all the way through. I would like to hang out with Benny more in City of God. But neither of those movies I would change. I would just, right. You know, it would be nice to have like a side movie with those guys.
I also did not. I'm not saying I would rather see this than the movie we got, but you know, it's funny. I did two, and one of them's an animal. Jinxie the cat in Meet the Parents, who Ben Stiller accidentally lets out, and then there's a whole plot point where he goes gets an identical looking cat and paints it. He paints its tail,
yeah,
and presents it to the family as, because he's so clueless about cats, he thinks this will work. And then eventually Jinxie shows back up at the end. So I like to think that Jinxie has, you know, like a little cat adventure throughout the neighborhood and meets some other animals and whatnot. I'd like to see.
Yeah.
That. And then also, I would like to see Matthew McConaughey's character in Tropic Thunder.
Definitely.
From his journey from L.A., to Vietnam or wherever he ends up.
Yes,
and
yes.
How he ends up there with the TiVo box to stop the rocket launcher, because I bet that would be quite an adventure.
Yes.
But I really liked that question.
Anything
fun in the chat?
Over in the chat we have Colossus TV says, I want a whole spinoff for the animals in the new Pinocchio movie. They look and perform better than the whole rest of the film. I haven't seen this new Pinocchio, but I've heard a lot of bad things. Polly says R2-D2 and C-3PO in Star Wars. Well, if they're not as annoying as they are in the prequels and the following films, I'd be totally down with that.
Yes.
Poop Notch says Baxter the animated series. Yes. James Kinder says it would have been cool to follow Hong Chow in the cereal box she purportedly hitched a ride in before she reappeared in Downsizing. Hong Chow is the best part of Downsizing. She's the reason to watch that movie. It's because she's so good. Titanic, there's so many stories from the real story that would be insane to watch. This is Joseph saying this. Yeah, absolutely. And when they were talking about Titanic sequels, and everybody was laughing like, ha ha ha, how do you make a sequel to Titanic? Well, you wouldn't make a sequel to it, I don't think. You'd make a sidequel, essentially, where you'd have other people on the boat having different stories or whatever. That's what I always thought they meant when they were talking about doing a sequel to this. But yeah, he says, is like the baker who is on the stern with Rose, who in real life got drunk as hell during the sinking and lived. Yeah, that would be an amazing story. Brother Ben says Brad Pitt's character in True Romance. Absolutely. He's hilarious in that movie. That's sort of like a precursor to him being in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, because he's just smoking weed the entire time in True Romance. Don't condescend me, man.
Have you killed?
Jagged says, what was Gandalf doing during the Two Towers? Yeah, he was at home washing his tights. That's right. That's going to do it for this episode of Wreckatopia. Hope you enjoyed The Changeling. Next week is Spontaneous. I can't wait to see that again. It was a pleasure, as always. I'm glad you guys came out in the chat. See ya. Bye. part of the live show by being a member of the Sin Club at Patreon at patreon.com/cinemasins. Chat with us on the CinemaSins Discord at discord.gg/cinemasins or CinemaSins Twitter at CinemaSins, and email any comments or questions to recotopia@cinemasins.com. That's recotopia@cinemasins.com.
Hey, three of my four cats threw up this morning.
Do you find that there's a seasonal thing about the cats throwing up? Because
I do.
My cats seem to do that often around winter.
I've also read that it can be like related to allergies. So like one of my cats, the oldest one, has been throwing up every day for like a week. But I've been having raging sneeze attacks almost every day. And my wife is like, you guys are both allergic to whatever's in the air right now. You're both allergic to the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
I'm like, all right. Yeah, sure. I mean, my mom always used to say, hey, they're cats. Cats throw up. But the more I pay attention to it, it does seem to come in waves. And I think it is kind of a seasonal thing.
Yeah.
Kind of like I actually recently learned my own heartburn can be seasonal and
really?
Inflated by allergies. Because I went like 4 or 5 months without having any heartburn issues. Before I had one, I was like, wow, it's been a long time since I've had heartburn.
Domino has this thing that I don't understand. He has a thing where he gets down in that position to cough something up and just doesn't. He does it all the time. Like, he's sitting there. Like, if you pick him up, like, from a sitting, like a lying down position, or he gets up too soon from a lying position or something, all of a sudden he's like, oh, no. Got something I gotta get going there, and he'll sit there and cough, but that's it. It's over. He's done that the whole time I've ever had him.
So, you think the Titans have turned it around for the most part?
No.
No?
I mean,
no confidence there?
No. I mean, do I still think it's too early to really know who is what and what they're going to be? Yes. But they need to solve this second half offensive thing. Like, I don't think it's – we can give credit to other teams for stopping them all we want to. But this is almost 0 points in the second half for four games. That's not a other team thing. That's your team thing.
Right.
And so during this Colts game – I was like, you better score again here in the first half, or you're not going to score ever again, considering what you've been doing the last 3 weeks. And they're going to come back on you. And guess what? They got really close to doing
that.
They did. So,
I never thought it would happen.
And you know, what do you say about the Colts, too? Like, what do you make of that team? You know, like.
Oh, I think they're pretty awful.
Awful, I mean, but they beat Kansas City.
Yeah.
Like, where does this come? Where does this stuff come from? You know, like I understand it's the NFL. Everybody's a professional. Blah blah blah. They all like to say that little like blah 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 blah. But Kansas City should be beating Indianapolis every single time.
Absolutely.
And so
that's why I'm surprised they're not 0-3-1 instead of 1-2-1. They should have lost. That game for sure, because Kansas City, didn't they just turn around and beat Tampa Bay?
Yeah, destroyed Tampa Bay.
Yeah.
So
maybe Kansas City just had a bad day.
Well, and so far I just haven't seen – I mean, the Bills had two games at the beginning of the season, which you can't grade much of anything on the first – because nobody's playing. Nobody's playing preseason games anymore. And these people are going out like cold, essentially, into their first games. And it's like, it's no wonder there's some teams that get destroyed 38-0. And you're like, they're not making the playoffs. And then everything's fine later. But
they finally get in the swing of things.
After the first 2 weeks, you would have thought, oh, the Bills, they're unstoppable, right? They destroyed the Rams. They destroyed the Titans. Then they lose to the Dolphins. And then they almost lose to, what was the game this past week? Baltimore. They nearly lost to Baltimore. And it's like, and this is a Baltimore team that gave up, you know, 800 yards to Tyreek Hill and Jalen Waddle in that one game, and suddenly the Bills can't do anything. I mean, it's just, and the Bills ended up winning that game. Bottom line, they won it, but you just, I get really annoyed every football season when the first 2 weeks go by and everybody's like, "Ah, this team is exactly what we think they are after those 2 weeks."
And they're doing this no preseason thing to avoid injury, right?
Which is dumb, by the way.
Yeah.
I mean, it's dumb. You can get hurt at any time. So I don't understand what this whole, well, we want to have them for the season. Like, you can get hurt in game one, too. So
yeah,
get some practice. God damn.
Yeah, it's really, I think that's what they've done, is they've gone so hard trying to avoid injury in the preseason that they've made the first five or six games of the season a preseason. Because
mm-hmm.
you used to be, you'd look at the preseason and it would be like, oh, the Browns undefeated in the preseason, and you'd laugh because that didn't mean anything. Mm-hmm. It didn't translate to the real season. Well, now that shifted to the first five, six games of the season.
Yeah.
You can't really know. Maybe Matt Ryan's going to turn into like a good player for the rest of the season.
Maybe. You never know.
Whatever he's been the first four games.
You really don't know. I mean, that's why I said I get really exhausted when everybody starts proclaiming things after the first couple of weeks. Because they think that's just going to happen over and over, and that like teams don't adjust to what they've seen in the first 2 weeks, that teams have bad days, and that they have, you know, other injuries, that a lot of the injuries, and I'm one of these people, I don't keep up with, you know, a lot of those offensive linemen and defensive linemen who get hurt and all that. Those are huge, like, ripple waves of, like, you know, and if they're not a name player, I don't even know what the impact of them being lost is going to be. But a lot of times these people who are just no names are like huge. They're huge. Yeah. And we don't know them. And then suddenly a team starts sucking and they're like, what happened to that team? Well,
yeah. Brad Dawkins got injured. Who's that?
Yeah, exactly. He was the number one rated interior lineman. Oh,
I saw yesterday that the Preds were playing a team in Switzerland,
mm-hmm.
or a team from Switzerland. I don't know if they went to Switzerland or hosted that team.
Yeah, I don't know either. I saw a little bit of that game on a replay, and I didn't stop to watch it, but I saw some of it. I don't know where they were. They may have gone to Switzerland. I don't know. I mean, I know
it's weird to me that
is it Forsberg from Switzerland.
Forsberg is from,
or is he Sweden?
Sweden, and yes, Sweden and Switzerland and Swiss and Holland and Amsterdam and
mm-hmm.
Netherlands. It's all the same place. It's all the same.
They're all the same place. They have no defining cultures.
Oh.